You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, menthol cigars and cigarettes have been marketed to African Americans for decades. 9 out of 10 black Wisconsin smokers use menthol products. As the FDA moves to ban menthol, we discuss resources for Wisconsin's communities of color. Now, a COVID-19 outbreak in India has reached a crisis level, with the country continuing to break its own records for new positive cases. In Wisconsin, cases remain low, but the pace of vaccinations has slowed in recent weeks, and we learned this week that many experts think the U.S. may not reach herd immunity. We're going to talk about each of those stories and take your calls and questions about the pandemic at 800-642-1234. What concerns you about the outbreak in India? What do you make of this idea that the U.S. probably won't hit herd immunity? Have your friends and family started to get vaccinated? What questions do you have? Ask us at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Jeff Potthoff is the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health. Dr. Potthoff, thanks for joining us again.
Good to be with you.
India is a long ways away. Help us understand why what's happening with India's outbreak is so influential across the globe, including here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, you know, what's going on in India is super concerning, and, you know, our hearts pour out for them. I think, you know, there was three things that kind of happened that created the environment that allowed their COVID cases to spin out of control after they had effectively almost claimed victory. You know, one was that they had a number of restrictions loosened, and it looked like things were going well. They started to pull back on their mitigation. And then secondly, it coincided with a time where there were societal events that gathered large numbers of people, religious events. And then, you know, the third thing was the presence of variants that are more contagious, may even be a little bit more deadly. And you mix that together in a bowl, and before you know it, it's out of control. And, you know, our greatest concerns back here in the U.S. last fall about overwhelmed health systems, which, you know, thankfully here in Wisconsin, we avoided. They didn't avoid there. And now we're seeing, you know, what happens when you completely overrun your country's healthcare resources and just the damage that that does to the population.
Yeah, there's incredible devastation with very sick people being turned away from hospitals because they just don't have the resources to help them. But back to this point that it's far away and it doesn't affect me, it sounds like variants are a big concern when you have such an outbreak that could spread around the world.
You're absolutely right. And I think, you know, when you look at kind of what turned it around for India in a bad way, we have the potential to do that here with one big caveat. Certainly, we've seen better numbers. Our mitigation is decreasing. And that's not a bad thing. You know, as numbers get better, we can take away some of the things that we've been doing. But we have to be very careful that we don't pull away our mitigation too quickly or too aggressively, or we've kind of done what India has done. And then, like you mentioned, we do have variants here in the United States, particularly the UK or the B117 variant, which, you know, is kind of that wild card as to how quickly can the virus spread. I think the big difference between the United States and, you know, particularly here in Wisconsin and India is the rate of vaccination. You know, the United States has done an okay job with vaccination. There's always room for improvement. That wasn't the story in India, despite being the country that was manufacturing more vaccines against COVID than any other one. They weren't necessarily getting to their people, and that set them up partly for this just, you know, horrible event that's going on right now.
Let's talk about those Wisconsin trends that you just touched on. The vaccination rate in Wisconsin is slowing. Are you concerned?
You know, I am concerned a little bit. You know, we've done okay as Wisconsin getting vaccinated, but we haven't reached enough people vaccinated where we can put COVID in the rearview mirror. You know, just it seems like just weeks ago, you know, the big concern was is we had way more people wanting to be vaccinated than we had vaccine to give. And now that's starting to reverse where we have more vaccine than we have people signing up to get vaccinated. And that really has us looking at, you know, two big things. One is for people who want to get vaccinated, are we ensuring that they have access? You know, we're meeting them where they are in their lives to make vaccination easy. And then two, for those who are eligible for a vaccine but haven't gotten it, let's understand what's behind there. You know, unfortunately, with vaccines, just like most things in this pandemic, there is so much misinformation out there. And even working clinically in the emergency department, I'll ask people if they're vaccinated. And if not, I ask why. You know, and some of the reasons that they give, it's just really interesting that that's out there and that people are believing these things that are just, you know, absolutely false.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff, who's the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and we're discussing the latest when it comes to COVID-19, what we need to know, and answering your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. What can you tell us, Dr. Potthoff, about what we're seeing when it comes to infection rates then in Wisconsin?
You know, we're doing all right. There was a time early April where we started to go up just a little bit. That was met with some increased hospitalizations a few weeks later, like you would expect. But that's tampered down. So, you know, the good news is infections are quite a bit lower than they were certainly in the fall, even going into winter. But I think it's also important to know that, you know, infections aren't low, that there is still a fair bit of COVID out there in the community. It's not like if you, you know, throw caution to the wind that you're not going to run into the virus, you will. But for the most part, we're on a good trend right now. And partly that has to do with vaccination. That helps. And then I think, you know, as much as we talk about folks who don't want to wear a mask and who don't want to distance, there's a lot of folks out there that are doing that when they need to do that. And it makes a big difference for us as a state. It's helping.
With more people getting vaccinated, do you anticipate the kind of intense spikes in cases like we saw throughout the winter?
You know, I think it's less likely, but I think the more important point is it's less likely in a very key demographic. When we look at the percent of people in Wisconsin 65 and older who are vaccinated, it's very high. That's also the group of people who we're most often seeing showing up to the hospital, being in our ICUs, and dying of COVID-19. So although I think there could be risk if we throw caution to the wind, just get back to normal with spikes of cases, I'm hopeful that those spikes won't be in that population of people who would be more likely to overwhelm the healthcare system, who would be more likely to get really sick and go to the hospital. Not to say there aren't going to be lots of examples of, you know, young people or younger people who get really sick, who go to the hospital, who end up dying, but hopefully not at the rate that we saw last fall when we really didn't have effective tools to keep those people safe.
Should we be concerned about more people getting back to normal life, even if there are places where we don't have a lot of uptick in the vaccinations in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's been one of the hard things with the latest guidance. So, you know, with lots of people vaccinated, there are things that if you're vaccinated are fairly safe to do. But if you're not vaccinated, they really aren't that safe to do. And I think when that guidance comes out, there's a number of folks who are unvaccinated who think, well, you know, if the vaccinated people can do it, it can't be that bad. I could do that too. And that's where we could run into a little bit of trouble. It's possible if we have, you know, large groups of unvaccinated people that would potentially be cohorting together. And the example that comes to my mind are actually children right now. Children can't really get vaccinated. You know, if they're all together, that's a big group of unvaccinated people. It gets pretty easy for the virus to potentially spread, especially those variants in those groups. And that could tip off a bit of a super spreader event if you have a large group of unvaccinated people together without mitigation in place.
We've got Tony from Egg Harbor on the line now. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. With the advent of all the PPE and hand sanitizers and ventilation systems with UVCG and HEPA filters, what I'm hearing from a lot of people is that they've not had their normal rhinovirus or mild case of the flu this year. And I'm wondering, are we actually hurting ourselves in a broad perspective that we're becoming so intolerant of any kind of infection that, given the state of unhealthiness in the country generally, are we leaving ourselves more open for very destructive results from getting a significant case of influenza?
Tony, thank you for that question about the immune system. Dr. Potthoff.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I hear. There's this perception that, you know, unless we're at a low level getting sick with diseases, our immune system might not be able to respond if we come in contact with these things on a less frequent basis. You know, our immune systems are pretty remarkable. So it actually is okay if we really decrease the rate of these common infections, influenza, rhinovirus, upper respiratory tract infections, because if you do happen to come in contact with them, your immune system will be able to react. It'll do just fine. On the flip side, you know, even some of these what we would consider mild illnesses, influenza and things like that, in certain populations, it's really not a good idea for people to come down with that at all, because they may get sick. They may not make it. And similar to COVID, there's even healthy people who really have, you know, no business getting really sick, who sometimes do with these other infections. So the caller's right. We saw almost no upper respiratory virus season this year, except for COVID. And that would be something we would definitely welcome every year if it was possible. Now, there needs to be a balance between, you know, really severe mitigation efforts that are in place right now, just because COVID was just so much more lethal than these other infections, and we didn't have vaccines. So I don't think you'll see things be quite as, you know, strict. But I could see going out of this pandemic, certain things that tend to stick with folks, likely not mandated, just because they don't want to get sick.
Yeah, or they don't want to get other people sick. I've heard people talking about maybe wearing masks when you have a cold to try to protect other people. So lots to think about there for sure. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Podhoff. He's the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and he's with us to talk about the COVID-19 crisis. We talked about how what's happening in India affects us, and now we're talking about vaccination rates close to home and herd immunity in Wisconsin. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? Maybe share an experience. Have you started to feel safer doing things out in public? What are some of the things you're not comfortable with right now? What do you want to know about herd immunity and how it works? Your COVID-19 questions right here at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We continue this conversation in just a moment. You're listening to Central Time. Well over a year into the COVID-19 pandemic, we still have so many questions about what's happening now and where we go from here. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're getting the latest health and safety information on the coronavirus from Dr. Jeff Podhoff. He's Chief Quality Officer for UW Health, and we're taking your calls on the Ideas Network. The number is 800-642-1234. Are you feeling optimistic about the direction the pandemic is headed these days? Are there still things that worry you, still questions you haven't gotten answers to? You can call now at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Podhoff, we need to talk about immunity. WPR reported recently on Madeline Island. That's a small island in northern Wisconsin. And their community recently hit about 80% vaccinated, but they're still not out of the woods. Can you talk about some of the complexities of this idea of herd immunity?
Yeah, you know, I wish it was just as simple as, you know, once you reach 70, 80%, you know, everything kind of goes back to normal and COVID becomes something that's only in the history books. You know, it's not quite like that. I don't want to minimize what a great achievement it is to be at that level of vaccination. It makes a huge difference. But what we'll see right now is when you talk about herd immunity, what you really mean is 70, 80% of like a broad swath of the population. If you have a certain part of the population that isn't immunized, that could create a problem for you. And right now, what we have is, you know, you might have a lot of people immunized, but you probably don't have your kids immunized. And then that does allow the virus to do a little bit better job of spreading than if that 70, 80% was across the entire population. So I think that's what you might see while we wait for these vaccines to be improved, you know, in younger people in our communities. But, you know, the other thing with herd immunity is it isn't a light switch. It's not like you don't have any benefit until you reach 70, 80%, and then all of a sudden, bam, there it is, and COVID goes away. There is value in vaccinating as many people as we can, even if we can't get to those herd immunity numbers. That does mean that for a lot of people, people. They don't have to worry about severe disease. But less than that 70-80%, you know, does mean that we will be having COVID kind of living with us. We will be, you know, hearing about people who are getting infected, either, you know, unvaccinated or, you know, tried to get vaccinated and it just didn't take. But at high percentages, it might be that we can manage that. You know, we'll still have COVID people in our hospitals. Some will get sick. We might be seeing, you know, COVID still in the headlines every once in a while. But it certainly is better to have more people vaccinated than less. Hmm.
Tracy from Spring Green is ready to join our conversation. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wondered, as the parent of a 12-year-old boy, how soon Wisconsin will be vaccinating kids that are 12 and under?
Great question, Tracy. Thank you for bringing that up. Dr. Potthoff, what do you know there?
Yeah, so right now, the Pfizer vaccine, it looks like we may get authorization for 12 to 15-year-olds as early as next week. And with the current turndown in vaccinations in the state, we know, at least at UW Health, we could vaccinate that group of people very quickly. I think we have about 14,000 12 to 15-year-olds that call UW Health kind of like their home for medicine, and we think we could get through them very quickly. So I think once that opens up, you'll see availability of appointments, and we'll be able to get those 12 to 15-year-olds vaccinated very quickly. Younger than 12, my best guess is probably early fall, say September. And I think, you know, we'll have Pfizer maybe approved in that period of time. At that point, we may also see some movement from Moderna. They're doing clinical trials right now. But I'm hopeful that, you know, age 2 through, say, 11, 12 might be able to get vaccinated coinciding with the start of the next school year.
And that's even earlier than even we were talking just a few weeks ago. Those dates have been moved up, that we're optimistic that instead of at the end of 2021 for those younger kids, that we might be even looking at fall.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things we found with these vaccines is they're outperforming our expectations. So I think, you know, when you're giving kind of initial estimates, a lot of it's based on kind of our historical context of, you know, how long does it take to get things figured out? How is the vaccine performing? And, you know, at least for these mRNA vaccines, they're exceeding our expectations. These timelines are able to be moved up.
We're talking with Dr. Jeff Potthoff with UW Health about the latest in COVID-19 trends and herd immunity. And we're taking your questions at 800-642-1234. We've got Colin in Wausau who has a question now. Hi, Colin.
Hi, thank you. I thought I heard something about President Biden loosening patent laws for the vaccine so that other countries around the world could producing. Is that true? And then on top of that, is there actual pushback, you know, from people saying don't loosen those patent laws because we developed it?
Colin, thanks for the question. Dr. Potthoff, what do you know about the global access to vaccines that Colin's talking about?
Yeah, this is a good question from Colin, and I'm not an expert in it, but basically the dialogue is really, you know, typically, if you're a pharmaceutical company and you've invested millions of dollars into research and development, you don't necessarily want to give away either, you know, the recipe or the technology for free for other people to be able to profit from that. I think COVID-19 raises an interesting question in this situation because COVID-19 affects all of us. If we do really good job of vaccinating the United States, but the rest of the world doesn't do a good job, it kind of works against us a little bit. So there's this idea that, you know, maybe for this pandemic, we should take a pause on the patent laws and say, you know, for the betterment of mankind, let's just teach everyone how to make these vaccines. We can have more manufacturing plants make them. We can get people vaccinated quicker. And we put this pandemic to an end quicker. And it's true that, you know, some companies may not make as much money. We might not bring as much money into the United States, but we will do a tremendous good deed for humanity. And I think that's where the discussion is on some of this patent law stuff.
And President Biden did throw his support behind that World Trade Organization proposal to waive intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines. So that is related. We had a call from Rhonda in Eau Claire who couldn't stay with us. Rhonda's question is there a difference between the vaccines approved for adults and the ones they're trying to use in children, Dr. Potthoff?
Yeah, I don't have all the details. In general, there won't be much of a difference. Usually the differences that we see is usually in dosing. So I don't know if the Pfizer vaccine, which will likely go up shortly, is a different dose, a different amount of vaccine that we give 12 to 15 year olds, or if it's the same adult dose. But structurally, they're not usually different. It's more a question of dosing. What dose do we need to be effective? And that could be something that you'd see changed.
And my assumption is you would want to give the lowest dose you can to elicit an immune response. But is that what it is? Or is there another are there other variables that you think about when trying to dose children with vaccines?
Yeah, usually when they're looking at those children, they're going to look at, you know, what dose gives the most robust response. Mm-hmm. And if you get a robust response at a higher dose and a lower dose, well, yeah, then you'd pick that lower dose. And then that has all kinds of benefits. You know, it's less material that the person is exposed to. It's easier to manufacture in large quantities because you might be able to get more doses, say, out of a vial. So they do typically go towards lowest dose as long as it's effective.
Sure. Yeah, that effective piece of it is so critical. So much has happened since we first learned of COVID-19. And I know we've talked to you several times. So big question here, what are you watching next in this pandemic?
Yeah, you know, right now I'm watching as restrictions loosen. That makes me happy. And then I hope that we can just kind of hold it together for the rest of the summer as we try to come out of this pandemic. I know myself, my family, everyone I talk to, we are all just ready to get back to things. And that's good. But we just have to make sure we're taking the right precautions so that we don't have any hiccups on the way out of this. And then really trying to think, how can I, as a physician, effectively talk to, communicate with folks who are hesitant, you know, getting that vaccine? When I look at it, there's just so few people who shouldn't be getting vaccinated. I really want to understand, you know, what is concerning people? Why don't they want to get vaccinated? And I know all other physicians are like that. If you're not sure about whether you want to get a vaccine or not, you heard something, call up your doctor and say, hey, this is what I'm worried about. This is what I heard. You know, talk to me straight. Should I get a vaccine or not? And take that advice. We're out there to help people.
Dr. Potthoff, thank you for being with us today.
You bet. Anytime.
That was Dr. Jeff Potthoff. He's the Chief Quality Officer for UW Health. We recapped what we know about COVID-19 now, between vaccines and immunity and infection risks, and what we should feel more comfortable doing at this stage in the pandemic and how to hold on a little bit longer. If you're curious to learn more about herd immunity, you can tune into the morning show tomorrow. They'll take a deep dive into the topic in the morning. That conversation starts at 7:30. Coming up still on Central Time, the FDA aims to take menthol smoking products off the market. The tobacco industry is ready to respond with lawsuits. Learn what it means for Wisconsin next. I'm Keely Boltina. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. One third of American adults are now fully vaccinated, but millions still haven't rolled up their sleeves. Jen White is back with the country's best experts to answer more of your questions about vaccines and the vaccine rollout. That's today on 1A Plus, starting at 6 o'clock this evening. Now, the Food and Drug Administration announced last week plans to ban menthol in cigarettes and cigars, effectively taking them off the market. In the past, tobacco companies have advertised menthol products to specific populations, including African Americans. Advocates say this has increased health disparities in Black communities. Canada successfully banned menthols. We're talking about whether the United States could do the same. Our guests are committed to tobacco prevention and are here to break down what impact a menthol ban could have on Wisconsin communities. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Smokers, how do you use menthol products? Would you support a ban? Maybe you started smoking with menthol products. What does this make you think of? Call 800-642-1234 or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Lorraine Lathan is founder and president of Jump at the Sun Consultants. That's an organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. Lorraine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Megan Piper is an associate professor in the University of Wisconsin Department of Medicine and the associate director of research at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. She's got a PhD in clinical psychology, and she's the president of the Society for Research on Nicotine and Tobacco. Megan, thank you for joining us again here on the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan, let's start and look at the big picture. What effect could a menthol ban have on public health?
The hope that this menthol ban brings to public health is huge. The reason that this ban has such great potential is not only because it will eliminate the product that the vast majority of young people start smoking with, but it also has the promise to really help reduce the racial differences, the racial inequities that we see in smoking rates and deaths due to smoking.
And Lorraine, how do you see a menthol ban helping Wisconsin communities?
Well, we're thrilled with the fact that the Biden administration is moving in that direction. In the state of Wisconsin, we know that tobacco is an unequal killer, that actually the adult smoking rate for African Americans in our state is nearly double that of the general population. So we smoke at about 26%, whereas the general population is smoking at about 16%. So we look at this as an opportunity to save lives. Each and every year, 45,000 African Americans die as a result of tobacco.
People talk about cigarettes, Lorraine, as a choice, although we also recognize it's an addiction. So how do you respond to people who say, well, maybe more Black people smoke more? Why is that an issue for public health? Help us clear that skepticism up.
That's a good question. True, tobacco is an addiction. Nicotine is an addiction. However, the tobacco industry has been targeting African American communities for decades, dating back to the 50s. It's not by happenstance that we have these tobacco disparities. We did a number of studies here in our state, and we noticed that the advertising is much more prominent in African-American and low-income communities. Tobacco products are within reach, eye level of children. The amount of money that the tobacco industry spends, $1 million an hour, just to market its products to us. So I would have to push back when people say it's a choice. I don't think it's a choice when you live in a neighborhood where all you see is tobacco advertising. You don't see healthy foods. You don't see healthy options. So it's intentional. And also just, and I think that maybe Megan can also speak to this. We know that with menthol, that it is easier to start and more difficult to quit, that the nicotine levels are very high. That makes it more addictive. We also know that African Americans tend to start smoking at a later age in life. They smoke fewer cigarettes. However, they die at higher numbers than the general population.
Hmm. Lorraine, thank you for that. And Megan, mm-hmm. tell us more about why menthol is so dangerous.
Sure. I think Lorraine just laid out a couple really important points, and that is that, first of all, the tobacco industries have not only targeted African Americans with tobacco advertising, but they've targeted it with menthol advertising. Back in the 1950s, as she mentioned, there was only a 3 percentage point difference between menthol smoking in white smokers and African American smokers. And the tobacco industry seized on that. And Brown and Williams really jumped to promote Cools, which is a menthol brand. And the idea with menthol, right, is that it's a mint flavor, so it's a little more appealing to youth. And it also has this anesthetic property. It makes it easier to smoke. It doesn't hurt your throat as much. Again, that's why the vast majority of youth start with this product. And it was sort of advertised as this cool, clean product for a long time. People thought maybe it was safer. It's not any safer than a regular combusted cigarette. A combusted cigarette, menthol or not, has almost 7,000 chemicals in them, more than 70 of which are carcinogenic, causing cancer. And so when we have this really focused push for a specific type of product, these menthol cigarettes, in the African American community. It's a big problem. And the reason it's a problem is, as Lorraine said, this is the product that they use to get people hooked. And despite the fact that African American smokers make more quit attempts, they're less likely to be successful. In fact, anyone smoking a menthol cigarette is less likely to be successful when they try to quit. So when they keep on smoking, they keep on being subject to all of the multitude of health effects from exposure to combusted tobacco products.
Megan Piper is president of the Society for Research on Nicotine and Tobacco. We're also talking with Lorraine Lathan, who is founder and president of Jump at the Sun Consultants, working with tobacco prevention for African Americans. And we're taking your call as we talk about the FDA signaling they'd like to ban menthol cigarettes and cigars. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about smoking rates and health disparities in Wisconsin? Maybe you have an experience with menthol tobacco products and want to share it with us. Now is the time at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. And Lorraine, how have menthol products really specifically been marketed to the Black community? What do we know about how that's affected Black Wisconsinites?
Well, what I can say is it has been marketed to our community in ways, unprecedented ways, in terms of the tobacco industry has paid Black political leaders, sponsors of historically Black colleges, festivals, Black-owned newspapers, and other prominent civil rights organizations. So it's difficult when you might be a civil rights organization, you're trying to make a difference in your community, and it's hard to walk away from money that you know can do good in your community. So they've co-opted our culture, and they've co-opted a number of our organizations. And this goes back years and decades. Festivals, they used to come into the community and give away tobacco products. I know a few years ago, I was actually at Summerfest and they had the cool Newport. I don't know if I'm supposed to say tobacco names, but they had a van there that was giving coupons away. So they make the products less expensive in our communities and more available in our communities.
Right, which is how we start to then tie it into the fact that menthol products are connected to health disparities, because if Black communities are targeted and more people who are Black use the products, we're going to see the effects of that.
That's correct.
Megan, Canada banned menthol smoking products. What are you looking at when it comes to our neighbors to the north to see if this is a real possibility in the United States?
Sure. So between 2016 and 2018, Canada banned menthol flavoring in cigarettes in 7 different provinces. And they did research. They looked to see what would happen. And what they found is about 60% of those smokers switched to a non-menthol product, and almost 1 in 5 smokers quit. So if there is a public health policy that could result in 1 in 5 smokers actually being able to quit smoking, I think that would be a huge health win. And again, because the vast majority of the people smoking menthols are African American, this would be a huge win for the African American community. The other issue that happened, about 20%, if anyone's doing the math along with me, they still smoke menthol in Canada, and they get those menthol cigarettes from First Nation reserves, reservations is what they call them there. And so that's something else that we're going to have to look at, some unintended consequences. However, the huge public health win of being able to not legally purchase within the United States, excluding reservations, menthol cigarettes, really has a powerful potential for improving public health.
We've got Andrew in Whitewater on the line who has a question that ties into that. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. How are you guys doing?
Good, thanks. So what's on your mind?
So my question for the guests would be what their thoughts are on what the proper role of government should be. Do you believe that government should be able to tell we, the citizens, we, the people, what we are allowed to eat drink, or in this case, smoke, do you think that's the proper role of government?
Andrew,
do you think that, you know,
that it's not. Yeah, Andrew, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but we definitely got your point. And it seems to tie into what you were just talking about, Megan, because Andrew is positing this scenario about liberty, freedom versus public health. And how do you respond to Andrew?
You know, I think that this is one of these complicated situations. And, you know, we live in a land where we do have laws and rules to protect health. And we live in a country where we try to balance those things. And so what we want to do is, nobody is saying you can't have cigarettes. That's not on the table. We're saying maybe we should take out an artificial flavoring that was deliberately added in to make it easier for people to smoke and thereby hook certain populations, get young people started. And so I think that what we're trying to do here is balance people's rights, as you say, to eat what they want and drink what they want, with the need to really make sure that the products that people have available to them are ones that are the least deadly.
We're discussing the FDA's plan to ban menthol smoking products with Megan Piper of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention and Lorraine Lathan, whose organization supports No Menthol Sunday, which is observed on May 16th. We'll talk about that ahead. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about menthol cigarettes and how they've been marketed by tobacco companies over the years? What do you want to know about how they're used in Wisconsin? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can join in as this conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. The FDA is looking to ban menthol smoking products. Tobacco companies are likely to challenge that. We're talking about it here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guests are Lorraine Lathan, who's with the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network, and Megan Piper, who's the president of the Society for Research on Nicotine and Tobacco. They're helping us understand what comes next. There's still a line for you in this conversation. The number is 800-642-1234. Can share your experience with menthol tobacco products, or you can ask a question about these products and the way they're marketed and used. The organization, Lorraine, that you have sponsors No Menthol Sundays. Here is Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes speaking in support of this event.
7,700 deaths in Wisconsin are linked to tobacco use or exposure each year, and it remains the number one cause of preventable death in the United States. But it's even more important to me as a Black man in Wisconsin, because we've already faced so many significant racial disparities. And when it comes to health outcomes, it's no different. And the well-being of Black people in our state, even without the issue of smoking, is something that's prevalent and requires us to take immediate action on.
And one of those ways to take immediate action is No Menthol Sunday. Lorraine, what is that?
Thank you. So No Menthol Sunday, our organization has been involved in it for the last 6 years. It's a national movement that is sponsored by the Center for Black Health and Equity and supported in our state by the African American Tobacco Prevention Network. It's an opportunity, and we say No Menthol Sunday, which is May 16th, but there are events that occur all the entire week leading up to that Sunday. So No Menthol Sunday is an opportunity for communities of faith to come together to educate one another and their congregants on the harms of tobacco. Our theme for this year is A New Day, and this represents an opportunity to renew your commitment to help loved ones who are addicted to break that cycle of addiction. It also is an opportunity for you, if you're a smoker, to get the support that you need in order to quit smoking. So we do a number of things. We have pastors that will deliver sermons. We have spoken word poetry. We have our youth and adult coloring book So a number of activities. And we also work with our tobacco retailers. On that day in Milwaukee, you will see participants that will have signs up that will say, in observance of No Menthol Sunday, we will not be selling mentholated tobacco products. And even last year, in the middle of the pandemic, when it just started, we had those retailers that were committed to not selling tobacco, and they used it as an opportunity to educate their customers when they came in. So there's a host of activities. We've expanded it throughout their state. This is something I forgot to mention, that it is now international. It's global. We are also working and supporting efforts in Africa and other countries as well.
You know, that struck me, this idea that you have retailers who make money from selling these products say, we're not going to sell them right now. Lorraine, what do you make of that?
It's pretty amazing. We're excited about our partners. We started working with tobacco retailers a few years ago, and what we were hearing from the community is that there was a concern of retailers that were breaking the law by selling what we call loosies. So those are cigarettes out of the package. The state certainly can't collect taxes on those. And it's a pathway to addiction because it makes cigarette or tobacco products cheaper for young people and low-income communities. And so it was tobacco industries that were not selling to minors that were respecting the law that got upset and came to us and said, we want to be a part. How can you help us? We want to be a part of your movement. And so we launched a campaign, No Singles, No Loosies, where we recognize those retailers for not selling to minors and not selling the loosies or the singles. We went back to them for No Menthol Sunday, and we said, would you support us in not selling tobacco products on May, last year was May 17th? And they agreed to. We were really surprised because they had, you know, some of them had lost income because of the pandemic. But they stuck to their commitment, and they said that one of the reasons they did it is they said that these could be our, we want our customers to live. We don't want our customers to die from these products. Some of these kids are, I see my kids in them. And so it's an opportunity for them to educate their customers on that particular day. We have some retailers that have gone beyond just that one day. So we're pretty excited to have them on board.
Lorraine Lathan leads an organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention Network. Megan Piper is the Associate Director of Research at the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. And we have a caller now who'd like to join us, Gianni in Marquette County. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good afternoon. And a very poignant topic. I'm glad you're talking about it. I understand the addiction to menthol cigarettes. I used them several decades ago, and I was able to stop. But they are highly addictive, nicotine in general. And I'm wondering if the guest would support an overall phase out of nicotine products as a whole in the next decade. That's my first question. And my second question is, how does the United States compare with Asia in its smoking rates? We're quitting, but they seem to be increasing.
All right. Gianni, thank you so much. Megan, do you have any information about how the U.S. compares internationally?
Sure. The U.S. actually does very well compared to some of our international counterparts. And it has to do a lot with what the government is doing. So, for example, in China, the government owns the tobacco industry. So the government profits from the tobacco products sold in China. There are also cultural issues in China where cigarettes are seen as a gift. You would take a gift if you were to visit someone's house, mm-hmm. and cigarettes are a very common gift. So there are both policy as well as cultural practices in Asia specifically that make tobacco use very prominent there.
And I think we have a pretty quick, easy yes or no question there with should we be working to ban all tobacco products if we're worried about health? Lorraine, what do you think?
Of course, I would say yes, we should. I mean, our goal is, when I think of the next generation, is to have a smoke-free generation. We want our communities, our children, and our adults to be thriving. So I personally would want to move in that direction.
And Megan, people might see this menthol ban as negatively impacting smokers. What steps do we need to take to ensure that menthol smokers aren't hurt in this process?
That is a great question, because, again, the hope here is that this is actually going to be something that helps menthol smokers primarily by motivating them to quit smoking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Lorraine and others have already said, quitting smoking is incredibly difficult. It is a powerful addiction, and most folks need help to quit. But there are lots of different resources for quitting. There are lots of different medications that you can get, either over the counter or from your physician, that will help you with those cravings and withdrawal symptoms. There's lots of different ways to get coaching and support. You could talk to friends who've already gone through it. You could call the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. They will talk to you for free. They'll actually even send you 2 weeks of nicotine replacement therapy for free, either the nicotine patches, or I believe it's the gum or the lozenges. Or you could go online. You could go to smokefree.gov, which is a website run by the National Cancer Institute. And there are also different apps, different texting programs. So my hope is that people who smoke menthol cigarettes will view this as an opportunity to make a quit attempt, and that they will use all the resources, everything that the science says will double or triple their chances of quitting.
Megan, thank you so much for being here. Also, thank you to Lorraine. Megan Piper is an associate professor in the University of Wisconsin Department of Medicine, and Lorraine Lathan is founder and president of an organization that administers the Wisconsin African American Tobacco Prevention and Poverty Network. This is Central Time.